from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the master tenant of an Oakland warehouse who's been charged with involuntary manslaughter in the deaths of 36 people took the stand this week. We look at the testimony of Derek Almena 2.5 years after the Ghost Ship warehouse blaze. Then Governor Gavin Newsom is poised to sign into law complicated changes to the way California pays for wildfire damage caused by utilities. Newsom says the overhaul will help fire victims and customers. But some critics say it amounts to a bailout for PG&E. We look at the law's impact. Forum starts after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The defense rested its case yesterday following the testimony of Derek Almena, master tenant of the Ghost Ship warehouse, where 36 people died in a fire there in December of 2016. Almena and co-defendant Max Harris each face 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter. We look at the impact of Almena's testimony this week and the strength of his defense with Don Clyde. He's a KQED reporter who has been in the courtroom all week reporting on Derek Almena's testimony. Good morning, Don Clyde.
Good morning.
And also David Levine joins us. He's a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. And David Levine, one of the memorable moments from yesterday when the defense rested was when Derek Almena said that he wasn't trying to blame anyone for what happened at the Ghost Ship that night in December. But of course, deflecting blame is a core part of the defense strategy.
Right, absolutely. The whole strategy is it was somebody else. We had no idea this was dangerous, and everybody else should take responsibility, whether it's the city, whether it's the landlords, whether it's these mysterious arsonists.
Meaning the way that the Ghost Ship was constructed.
Exactly. That if a danger was created, it was not Almena and Harris's responsibility, that it was anybody else's. So the idea that he's saying, I'm not casting aspersions, I'm not placing blame, anything like that, is so contradicted by evidence as well as I just can't see it hanging together for the jury.
Yes, you mentioned that he was trying to blame city officials, the landlords of the place, even the argument that it was arson that started this fire as well.
That's right. That's quite right. It's anybody but us.
And so how did that moment, Don Clyde, go over in the courtroom when he said that he wasn't trying to blame anyone?
There are several relatives of victims in the audience, and several of them laughed. They kind of scoffed at that notion that he was not casting blame on anybody. The statement that he was not blaming anybody came from a question from District Attorney Autry James, in which he said, did you say to KTVU that the core of your essential defense was going to be that you were going to point and blame? And so this was really a contradictory statement to what had been said before.
One of the things that you reported on Monday, Don Clyde, when Derek Almena first took the stand, was how he couldn't even basically say his name without breaking down. Can you describe that scene for us a little bit? The very beginning of the week.
Almena took the stand, and he was asked by the court to pronounce and spell his last name. He broke down in between and essentially really choked up, and was difficult for him to get out the spelling of his last name. Sarah then went on to ask him, how are you? He responded he was exhausted. He hadn't been sleeping. He's been in Santa Rita jail for 2 years. Sarah then went on to ask him if he felt responsible for the night of the fire and the deaths that had happened. And he said he did feel responsible. His quote was that, I invited beautiful people into my space. Sarah also went on and asked if he felt remorse or contrition for the event. And he said, I feel death, a loss of life. They were beautiful, beautiful people. Now, if you go back to August of...
Just 1 second. I want to ask David Levine what Almena's attorney, Tony Serra, is trying to do here.
What he's trying to do is to humanize Derek Almena. That's the problem. And the problem in the sense that you want to humanize him so that then you can say this was just a terrible, awful accident, but not one for which we can place criminal responsibility. So anything you can do to humanize him. So, for example, they use a picture of Almena and his family, that sort of thing. Anything you can do to make him look as normal, as human, and as much a victim as the decedents, that's the strategy.
And Don Claude, you mentioned last August. What happened last August?
There was an attempted plea agreement, and the judge essentially threw out that plea agreement because he did not have the indication that Almena had exhibited enough remorse in the case.
So you think Almena was trying to make up for that?
It appears that might have been a defense strategy.
And again, we're talking with Don Claude, KQED reporter who's been covering the Ghost Ship trial this week, where the defense rested, and David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. They join us for this half hour, and I want to open the phone lines now in case you have questions, comments, or reactions to Almena's testimony this week that you'd like to share with us. Also, questions for our guests on the strategies of the defense attorneys. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, on Facebook, tweet us at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. David Levine, talk a little bit about the prosecution's strategy here. What do they need to do?
Prosecution needs to show that Almena and Harris were not just negligent in a civil sense, careless, merely careless, that in hindsight, maybe they should have done something. What they need to do, what the prosecution needs to do, is to show that there were caution signs, there were red lights, and that Almena and Harris went through them time after time. That's why the prosecution keeps saying no exit, no time, no warning. Focused on no exit signs, no sprinklers, no fire extinguishers, all these things. And also the lies that Harris and Almena told, for example, two officials who came to the door. No, nobody's living here, that sort of thing. Because you have to show that the two defendants acted in reckless disregard, way beyond what any reasonable person would have done in that situation.
So, as usual, the prosecution really has a much higher burden here.
Always, because the prosecution has to prove the case, every element of the offense, beyond a reasonable doubt. So one of the things the defense may try to do in closing arguments is to continue to plant seeds of doubt, to say, in hindsight, this was a tragedy. In hindsight, these two fine young men should have done something different, but it doesn't rise to the level of criminality. And of course, the prosecution is going to flip that around, is going to paint very different pictures of these two people.
And Don Claude, when are closing arguments scheduled?
Judge Trina Thompson expects that closing arguments will begin on July 29th, and she expects they will last from probably 3 to 4 days.
And so based on your observations this week, where did you feel like the prosecution was really able to land some points in this trial?
Prosecutors really hammered away at the lack of permits for work that was done at the warehouse that included installing a side door, that included installing a front set of stairs, electrical work and plumbing. Almena testified under cross-examination that he had gotten no permits for any of that work. He also didn't get any permits for the type of concerts, like the night of the tragedy. He didn't have those kind of operational permits.
The concert on the second floor of that building that, as I understand it, had only one exit, and that was just a very rickety staircase.
Right, that's right.
David
that's
Levine.
Right. To me, if I were the prosecution, I would focus on that party because it seems to me there's a even higher level of danger when you bring people in who are strangers to the building as compared to the residents who are living on the ground floor who might have known their way around. It might be a fire trap, but they might know their way around. They brought strangers in for this party. as you said, second floor, very rickety, jerry-built staircase, no other exits. I think there were bars on the windows, so it was just no other way out, so that it really was literally a fire trap.
Well, Jake writes, Almena is a renter, not the owner. That means he could not be responsible for installing a sprinkler system. Who was responsible for making the building safe? The owner was. Why Chorang hasn't been charged is a complete mystery to me. David Levine, what about the responsibility of the landlords?
Well, I think in this case, I would say it's joint responsibility. It is surprising that the landlords were not charged here. I guess the only explanation is that the prosecutors didn't feel that there was enough evidence that the landlords acted in reckless disregard as the law requires. But you can certainly in a civil case, you could point the fingers to them because the standards are a little bit different. But here we have to focus on these defendants. Almena was the master tenant. He is the one who was subleasing to these others. So he certainly in the law bears some responsibility, significant responsibility. You can't put this only on the landlord as a matter of law.
There was a moment, though, Don Clyde, when it seemed like the prosecution was able to prove or at least show some evidence that the landlords had asked Almena to get permits for some of the construction he was doing.
Audrey James was specifically referring to a 23-page document that Almena had written while in custody. He wrote that in the early stages, after he had acquired the warehouse in 2013, November, that in it, Eva Ng, one of the landlords, had written, please provide permits for work that's going to be done at the warehouse. He also testified that he said, no, he was not going to get the permits. He requested that Eva Ng and the landlords get the permits for the work. He's also said at other times that he had assumed that contractors that he was hiring were going to also get those permits for the work.
And again, Don Clyde is a reporter for KQED. David Levine, a professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. They're with us for a half hour. The number 866-733-6786 for your questions and comments. 866-733-6786. Email address forum at kqed.org. You can also reach us on our website, on Facebook, and you can tweet us at KQED Forum. There was a moment, David Levine, when essentially the attorney for Max Harris, the co-defendant here, said that Almena essentially exonerated him by limiting his role. He has been called a creative director. He's been called a second in command, but really limiting his role and knowledge. Do you think that equated to an exoneration?
It's not an exoneration.
The How
certainly
helpful.
Well,
yeah.
In the sense that, I mean, Harris was there. Harris certainly did a lot of work for this entity. You can't call it an organization exactly. Certainly was part of the party. I think he was the one collecting money for the party, and he certainly had a role in that. And it seems to me, again, I would focus on how the party itself just made the risk skyrocket. It's just much, much worse to have these strangers on the second floor than to have people on the ground floor where they at least would have some knowledge of the risks of being there.
And can I also
Yes, Don Clyde.
Part of the Curtis Briggs, who represents Max Harris, also said that a lot of the work that had been done on the warehouse was actually done before he had actually come in to live there. That was part of what he considered an exoneration of his client, that he did not have part of you know, not obtaining permits for certain work there.
Yeah, I think you can say Harris is less culpable. Remember, with the plea deal, Harris had pled to a shorter jail sentence or prison sentence than Almeida. So I think everybody recognizes that. It's the question of, can you say that Harris should be completely exonerated? I mean, certainly part of their defense strategy has been to paint him as, you know, like this flower child, like he didn't know what was going on. Right. He's just part of the love and the art and nothing more, rather than what the prosecution wants to say, which is that he had a much more instrumental role, again, particularly with these parties.
How harmful was it to the prosecution, though, when there seemed to be a suggestion that the fire official who claimed that she'd never been in the building was actually being accused of lying and that she had been in the building?
Well, I think that is part of, I guess, some of the strongest evidence that the defense has to say officials, particularly these fire officials, knew what was going on. They never said there was a problem. They never, let's say, called in a higher level of inspector or something like that. Why didn't those people do something? Now, the counter to that is they were told by Almeida and Harris nobody was living there, right? It's an art collective. Nobody was living there. And I don't know that Almeida and Harris ever said, oh, by the way, we have parties upstairs. That might have triggered more. But certainly the idea that you had police and fire who kind of knew about the building, who talked to them, who certainly had an opportunity to view what was inside, that none of those people literally rang an alarm bell, certainly helps the defense to say, in hindsight, maybe we should have done things differently. But to say that we acted in reckless disregard when these experts, none of them said there's a problem here, I think really helps the defense.
Well, this listener writes, what precedent would this set if Almeida and Harris are criminally charged? Is this a precedent-setting case?
It's not a precedent-setting case. It's just an example of the use of involuntary manslaughter, which is used everywhere. But in California, we've had several cases like this. A famous one from not that long ago is Michael Jackson's doctor was convicted of involuntary manslaughter because he was over-prescribing Jackson at the end. And that really is what caused Michael Jackson's death. There's any number of other cases out there. So it's not precedent setting in that way. If it leads to better fire inspections across the country, then it will be helpful in terms of moving social policy. But it's not precedent setting in the way you would think. The Supreme Court issued an opinion declaring X, Y, or Z.
So, Don Clyde, you had mentioned that there were several family members of the victims in the courtroom. As they're seeing this final week unfold and the testimony of Derek Almeida, what were some of the reactions that you were seeing?
Colleen Dolan, who is the mother of Chelsea Faith Dolan, one of the victims of the night of the fire, spoke to media outside of court on Tuesday. And she said she essentially didn't believe anything that Almeida was saying. She called him a bad actor. She said that he spoke in, you know, indirect answers to questions. And she said that it would be a miracle if he could actually answer a question directly on the stand. This is part of going back to this kind of combative and frustrating nature of questioning between the prosecutor and Almeida.
Do you think, David Levine, that it was wise to put Derek Almeida on the stand? It's not like he has to be.
Absolutely. Criminal defendants have an absolute constitutional right not to testify. Most of the time in criminal trials, the criminal defendants do not testify because in most of the cases, it goes badly for them. The reason is that they are not as charming as they might themselves think in front of the jury, and then they open themselves up to withering cross-examination. So obviously, that was a huge roll of the dice for the defense lawyers. I know that Tony Serra, who is Almeida's lawyer, tends to want to put his criminal defendants on the stand. He thinks that that's helpful. But the conventional rule is criminal defendants stay far away from the jury, from the witness stand.
Yes. And do you think Serra feels that way because it communicates that this man doesn't have anything to hide, that he, you know, is going to come and bare his soul to you, essentially?
Sure. In fact, yeah, that's right. Because in this case, it's all tied to this judgment call, which is what was in the heads of these two defendants before the fire. And we know what happened in the sense that there was a fire. We know how these people died. We know the conditions of the place beforehand. It's not a matter of saying who pulled out a knife, who pulled out a gun, and trying to decide a factual matter in that way. What we're doing is asking the jury to apply a legal standard to a pretty much a set of known facts and just deciding, does this activity cross that line or not? A judgment call that who knows what they're going to say. This could go anyway.
But you didn't answer my initial question. If you were Tony Serra, if you're Almeida's lawyer, do you think that it was a smart move to put him on the stand?
We'll only know in hindsight. all I can tell you is it's a gutsy thing to do. Most criminal defense lawyers would not put their people on the stand, especially in this circumstance where there was so much information. So, for example, you have Almena's statement that the trial judge before thought was insufficiently remorseful. Don mentioned that Almena was interviewed on television. So you've got tape of him saying totally contradictory things. You've got video from the police officers, from the fire officials, with him saying totally opposite things. So in the face of all that material that you know is going to be used in cross-examination, to put him up there was gutsy. We'll see whether it was brilliant or stupid later on. But this is a very, very, very smart defense lawyer.
Well, Amanda writes, how much does the defendant's intention play into this?
A lot. Because, again, the issue is it's that you act in a reckless way, conscious disregard, effectively, of that danger, and that a reasonable person would have known that they should have acted otherwise. So it isn't so much intent in the same way of did you intend to kill somebody, because this is involuntary manslaughter, but it's really so much of what was in your head at the time and what should have been in your head at the time.
And Don, you mentioned that closing arguments are July 29th, but what could happen in the case between now and then? Is there any other activity scheduled?
On Monday, rebuttal witnesses are expected. Additional motions will be heard. It's not clear how long that will last, and it's not clear how many rebuttal witnesses there will be.
But there's still a process now. And then, I mean, once that part of the trial is over, obviously we'll be waiting for a verdict. But there are a lot of threads to this situation, to the events that happened in December of 2016. What are you watching for, David Levine?
Well, how the prosecutor and the defense lawyers put the story together. How compelling do those stories appear to be? As Don said, we're expecting several days of closing argument because there is so much evidence to walk through. They all are going to be creating competing narratives, and it's going to be up to the jury to decide which of those narratives hang together. What makes sense? What was were these two defendants credible? That's going to be so important, how they came across to the jury.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze in a call from Rachel in Sebastopol. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there. I'm curious whether or not if this case had gone to a restorative justice circle, what the folks in the interview booth there say the outcome might have been had that been how this resolution got handled.
Don or David, restorative justice?
Well, the
David Levine.
Sure. The idea of restorative justice is that you bring your victims and the defendant together, and together they talk through what happened, and the defendant makes some amends. This is a case that is far too grave to do anything like that, because we have 36 people who died. What can the defendant do to make amends there? If we're talking about something like shoplifting at a store, well, maybe you can make amends. You know, the defendant, you know, let's say some teenager comes in and says, okay, I'll clean the store for three Saturdays in a row or something like that. But a case like this would never go to something like restorative justice. It's a valuable tool, but for a very different kind of offense than this.
We've been talking about Derek Almena's testimony, the master tenant of the Oakland warehouse where 36 people died in a fire in 2016. He testified this week. The defense rested. Closing arguments are expected later this month. Thank you for your reporting this week, Don Clyde.
Thank you.
Don Clyde, reporter for KQED, and David Levine, professor at UC Hastings College of the Law. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. We'll be talking wildfire law next, so stay with us for that. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.